And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Nerdtastic Podcast, Nerdy Notions with Sasha Kaplan.
Thank you for that fabulous introduction. And today we are talking about the man, the myth, the legend, the one who basically created comedy as we know it, or as we should appreciate it. And this is a man who actually 4 days ago celebrated his 93rd birthday. God bless this man. He is a true national treasure and a Jewish treasure at that. And of course, if you haven't figured it out yet, it's Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks, for those that don't know, was actually born Melvin Kaminsky on June 28th, 1926 in Brooklyn. Not Brooklyn, Brooklyn. And I have no shame in making the worst Brooklyn accent ever. Fight me. But this is a man who kind of grew up in a poor Jewish neighborhood. His father was a German Jew from Danzig, which is Poland, and his mother was a Jew from Kiev, which is, you know, at the time was part of the Russian Empire. So he was a child of immigrants, and he had many brothers, and he had a few brothers. I'm looking at his biography right now. I do not know all these things off the top of my head. I'm not that weird. But he kind of went through a lot of hardship. His father died when he was a young man, and he basically had to do a lot for his family the way they understand it. And one day, basically, he kind of ended up breaking into comedy, and he became the incredible treasure that we know today. He had two wives. The first, I think, ended in divorce, which was Florence Baum, and the second was Anne Bancroft. And he has four children, including the incredibly brilliant and man that deserves his own episode, his son, Max Brooks, who, while appearing in, I think, one or two of his father's films, I think just the one, also has a pretty great career as a writer and political theorist who uses pop culture to talk about political issues and political philosophy, which is pretty cool. But as cool as he is, we're still focusing on the funny parts. So, which movie do you think we should start with?
As I grab the collection for the third time in a row. You know what? Let's start with The Producers, because that was the one that got remade, and it's probably the only time a Mel Brooks movie will ever get remade.
This is fact. So The Producers were original. The original Producers was not a musical, but it was an incredible film that didn't really get the cult following that it does now back then. It had Zero Mostel as Max Bialystock and the great, 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 great man that he is, Gene Wilder, who played Leopold Bloom. And I'll be honest, this movie is a little bit too long, and it's a little, I don't think it's his best work. I know a lot of people will come at me with torches and pitchforks. I think the movie is great. I think the remake tried to really make it a musical, and I think that flowed a lot better.
I think it was also because of the Broadway, because it had been on Broadway for a while.
It was on Broadway. The first Mel Brooks musical, I think, to be on Broadway. It's an amazing musical. It's an amazing movie. The original, however, I do think that Gene Wilder was a better choice for Leopold Bloom than Matthew Broderick. And obviously, by the time The Producers was remade, I don't think Gene Wilder was doing much acting. But Gene Wilder, I keep going back to that blue blanket scene. Give me my blue blanket. And there's nobody that can compete with Gene Wilder. And that entire scene is just full of so much emotion. And I don't even know how much of that was stage directions from Mel Brooks or how much of it was just sheer talent that was Gene Wilder. It was just incredible. So it's definitely worth checking out, and it is a very successful Broadway musical. I own the new movie. Well, newer. I think it came out in 2005.
Yeah, it's been about 14 years.
And it is really funny. I think some of the humor and some of the sexual innuendo that Mel threw in didn't quite translate well to the 1967 audiences. But regardless, regardless of that, I do think that it set a precedent for the kind of man that Mel Brooks was. And I believe up to our, one could argue, what's the movie I'm looking for? Dracula Dead and Loving It. That was the only quote unquote flop. But even Dracula Dead and Loving It has some redeeming qualities because it's Mel Brooks. Even his worst movies are hilarious comedies.
Well, I think also one of the, saving grace is not just the fact that Dracula was a Mel Brooks film, but also the fact that you had Leslie Nielsen in the film.
Leslie Nielsen is the worst and best Dracula.
Yeah, but the thing is, though, is that I think this was also the film where Mel Brooks finally got to work with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think that was the whole point of it.
That does make sense.
Yeah.
I can just picture Mel Brooks doing like a remake of Naked Gun or something. Because if you haven't seen Leslie Nielsen in the Naked Gun movies or Airplane, please do. Airplane does not age well in certain scenes. But unlike Airplane, I think the funny thing about Mel Brooks is that his movies are timeless.
Yeah,
they transcend the concept of what was funny then versus what's funny now. And it's absolutely timeless. You can watch it as a person who grew up in the 60s and 70s and 80s. You can watch as a person who grew up in the 90s and the 2000s, and you still get it.
Yeah, but at the same time, and we'll talk more about it as we talk about more of the movies, because there's a couple movies on here when we talk about them, we're going to go, yeah, if they try putting that in theaters today, there's no way in hell you're going to be able to pull that off. But, and unfortunately, Producers is one of those films now. You know, simply because of how uppity people are about things.
I mean, there was a guy who, I think this was on the West Coast a few years ago, maybe 5 or 7, tried to stop or boycott the production of the musical of The Producers because, get this, it normalized Nazis.
Except it didn't, because Mel Brooks played one of the Nazis in the remake and made fun of it.
Right, but people don't understand that the more, this is the Mel Brooks philosophy, the more you make fun of something, the less power it has over you. And, I mean, this is the guy who did the Hitler rap. Like, this is a man who literally dressed up like Adolf Hitler at one point. Like, there is nothing funnier to me than a Jew playing Adolf Hitler, whether or not it's intentional or not, because you save yourself, and you're able to take away some of that power that such a figure has over you.
And the funny thing on top of that is that Mel Brooks also fought in World War II.
Yes, he did.
So he fought in World War II against the Nazis, and then he comes back and he does comedy. And what's one of the things he likes to poke fun at?
Yep.
The Nazis.
So according to Wikipedia, which, you know, take it with a grain of salt, he was drafted in 1944. And scored very high on the Army General Classification Test. This is a test that kind of shows you where you best going to fit. And the IQ test. I mean, let's be real. No person that has ever watched or heard Mel Brooks would think he's an idiot. So he was sent to an Army specialized program at the Virginia Military Institute. He was taught engineering, foreign languages, medicine. And he was... Basically, something was disbanded, and he was returned to basic training in Oklahoma in 44. He served as a corporal in the 1104th Engineer Combat Battalion and the 70th Infantry Division, defusing landmines as the Allies advanced into Nazi Germany. With the end of the war in Europe, Brooks took part in organizing shows for captured German and American forces. So... there was a lot of struggling, and I know we're going to talk about his movies, but we also have to talk about The 2000-Year-Old Man. And if you have not seen The 2000-Year-Old Man, it is him and Carl Reiner basically playing off each other. And Mel Brooks plays this figure who is definitely not Mel Brooks, who literally better live to be 2000. But he is the 2000-Year-Old Man, this man who has lived for 2,000 years, that roughly culminates in like the 60s or the late 50s. And Carl Reiner is interviewing him about what it means to be the 2,000 years old. I this is something that you have to remake today, because the jokes for today's audiences would fit so well in some of the humor. And I think they did an updated version of it in later on, but I think there needs to be one more version of the 2,000-year-old man. Just one more. But it's sheer hilarity, and God bless both him and Carl Reiner, because they are both alive and with us, and I wish them both many, many more years, because we will literally not survive without them. And it's something that I think is the key to kind of Mel Brooks's kind of thinking, and his, maybe it's the secret to his life, is the laughter. But he makes fun of everything and everyone. And most importantly, he makes fun of us. Because the epitome of Jewish humor is that we make fun of ourselves so no one else gets to.
Kind of like that Seinfeld episode where the guy married a Jew or converted to be a Jew just to do the jokes.
I've never seen Seinfeld.
That was the premise of one episode.
That's awesome.
The guy literally converted to be a Jew so he can make Jew jokes.
I mean, there's always like the nanny where like Niles would make some kind of weird like Jewish reference and she'd be like so proud of him. Or that one time where they're questioning, there's one episode where like, I think they're about to celebrate Christmas or something at the house, and Fran is talking about the Jewish holiday. No, sorry, there's a random episode basically where Fran is, they're talking about Jewish holidays, and Fran's like, yeah, I have this Jewish holiday coming up. And he's like, okay, is this the one where we starve for 5 hours and then stuff ourselves? Is it the one where we sit and read from a book and stuff ourselves? So in the realm of permissible humor, there are ways to get around it. And I think like the nanny managed to capture some of that like hilarious Jewish comedy without being too stereotypical, but the stereotypes are funny. You know, she has the overbearing Jewish mother. Her father never gets a word in. We only see him in one episode, really. You have the rivalry with the aunt and the mom, and it's just like, it's so funny. And her trying to teach Jewish things to the kids is just hilarious. But we're talking about Mel Brooks and his career and his movies, and
we just go on diatribes. It's okay.
And, you know, it's hard not to. There's so many good Jews in comedy. Note, Sarah Silverman is not one of them. She has the humor capacity of a stick. No. I'm sorry. The stick probably came from a very important piece of wood, and it's probably an important piece of, you know, tree bark, or it's a very nice tree, and it's very insulting to trees and nature to compare them to Sarah Silverman. There are a couple movies, I'll be honest. I think there's two or three that I have not seen, or one that I haven't seen in a very long time. And one of the movies that I tried to watch and kind of never got into were The 12 Chairs. Now, for me, there's a very good reason for that. And that's because the Soviet version is better.
The what version?
So The 12 Chairs that he made is, I don't know if this is like legit, but this is my theory, that it was, okay, so there's a Russian novel called The 12 Chairs. And I don't know if what time the Russian version came out. I'm going to look that up. But there's a Soviet version of the film, of a film adaptation of this book called The 12 Chairs. And there's a 1971 movie with Mel Brooks and...
1970.
Okay, 1970.
I have the years of the movies on the collection.
Of course you do. So the Russian version, the Soviet version, came out in 1971. So they basically were being filmed and they came out pretty much around the same time.
Yeah. You're looking at a year difference.
But I don't know, maybe because it's hard for me to like get around Americans playing Russians or whatever, but maybe I can I should rewatch it and see if my feelings still hold. But if you haven't seen it, the story of the 12 chairs is really interesting. Basically this, if I remember correctly,
the book.
So you're in the Soviet Union. It's just post-revolution, but pre-World War II. It's 1927. And an impoverished former Russian aristocrat is working in a village. And he goes to see his dying mother-in-law. And she reveals that she had this fortune of jewels. and they were hidden in, sewed inside these incredible chair seat cushions. So one of these 12 chairs from the family's dining room has these like incredible jewels. And so the whole thing is about, I think, like getting the chairs, and it's kind of like a heist, but not really. I think Frank, what's his name?
Frank Langella, isn't it? So I have the little mini version book from the collection. I have the bigger version, but that's boxed up somewhere for safekeeping. I'll just read real quick because it's like a quick little paragraph. Although the plot of 12 Chairs is wild enough to have been created by Mel Brooks, it's actually based on a Russian story written by two Soviet journalists, Ilya Ilf, I'm hoping I'm saying that right, and Evgeny Petrov in the 1920s, set in Russia in 1927. This much-loved, hilarious Mel Brooks comedy classic is a tale of a former aristocrat, played by Ron Moody, who is now a Russian clerk under the new Soviet regime. When he learns that his dying mother-in-law sewed a fortune of family jewels into one of the 12 dining room chairs, he sets off across Russia to find it. With an opponent, Frank Langella, a priest, Dom DeLuise, and his former servant, Mel Brooks, all in pursuit. And I'll do this for the other movies to help you out, since I haven't read in front of you.
That's the one that I just don't know much about, because I think the 12 Chairs and Silent Movie are the ones that like I've never really saw.
Oh, I love Silent Movie.
Me, I talk about the ones usually people know. But before we go to those, I want to talk about To Be or Not to Be.
All right, let me flip over to that in my little book.
It's okay, this one I got it. So this plot of To Be or Not to Be, first of all, it's a remake of another movie, but it's more colorful, and it takes place on September 1st, 1939. Does anybody know what magical event and slightly horrific event happens on September 1st, 1939?
The invasion of Poland.
The invasion of Poland is correct. You're reading the booklet thing, you don't get to guess.
Yeah, I'm totally reading the booklet thing.
The magical horrific event is, of course, the invasion of Poland. And everything starts at the Blonsky Theater, where Mel Brooks, who plays this guy named Blonsky, and it's his theater, and his wife is basically, like, she's there, but he's not. She's an actress. She's a very good actress, played by his wife, Anne Bancroft. And he's just not giving her, like, any attention at all. And she decides to meet with this hot young lieutenant from the Polish Air Force. And To Be or Not to Be is the line that she gives him. So Mel Brooks's character does this thing called Highlights from Hamlet. Yes, it's as bad as it sounds. But he goes in and he gives Hamlet soliloquy, To Be or Not to Be. And that was the cue for the lieutenant to get up, excuse himself, and go backstage to meet with Anne Bancroft. But before all this happens, Blonsky does a little skit. This is like SNL before television. Little skits, very comedic, very fun. And one of those things involves Adolf Hitler. So Mel Brooks is dressed as Adolf Hitler, and he's in front of a stage with a map. And he says, I don't want war. All I want is peace. Peace. And he breaks into song about how he wants a little piece of Poland, a little piece of France, a little piece of little piece of Poland, Belgium and Austria perchance, something like that. And of course, with this event and with everybody trying to, everybody's in the process of appeasing Hitler and trying not to annoy Hitler and hoping Hitler doesn't invade Poland, the Polish government shows up and says, kind of tells him to cease and desist. And so the adventure takes place in Nazi-occupied Poland.
Yeah. I love the laptop charging in the middle of a podcast episode.
Sorry about that. Had to make sure I didn't die in the middle.
Yeah.
It's hysterical the lengths that they go through. So obviously the first thing that the Nazis do when they're occupying Poland is, you know, take away everybody's wealth and form a Gestapo. And so there is this list of people who are involved in the Polish underground, which is the Polish resistance movement, resistance to the Nazis. And basically, and Bancroft's character and Mel Brooks's character, they get engulfed with this young lieutenant who's part of the Polish underground, and how basically they scheme and plot to get this Jewish troop out of Poland.
And oh my God, it's hilarious. This is one of those instances where Mel Brooks plays a character who gets to dress up and pretend to be Adolf Hitler. I wonder why nobody noticed that Adolf Hitler was significantly shorter, but you know, it's a movie.
So quick fact, co-starred Charles Dunning, who was nominated in 1983 for Best Supporting Actor, Oscar nominated, as a SS colonel who stands in their way. He actually, so that's one of, I don't think there were many Oscar nominations for any of Mel Brooks's films, but this is one of the few that was there.
That's actually a really awesome bit of trivia. And so the original film, same plot basically, was To Be or Not to Be, which was made in 1942.
By Ernest Lubitsch.
Yep, which starred Jack Benny, Robert Stack, and Carol Lombard. And during the Nazi occupation of Poland, an acting troupe becomes enrolled in a Polish soldier's efforts to track down a German spy. I believe Jose Carreras is in this as well, in the remake, not the 1942 version, and he plays some guy whose name I can no longer remember. But it's definitely making fun of Nazis. It's definitely like, this one doesn't shy away. This is, I think, the only movie that really doesn't shy away from how horrible Nazis are. There's a scene where Anne Bancroft's character's obviously gay assistant, Sasha. No, yes, Sasha. And how he's like taken, arrested, and beaten up by the Gestapo and made to wear the pink triangle. And you see how the Max and Anne Bancroft's characters, they were wealthy. They were doing very well because they owned a theater. It was doing well business-wise. But their wealth was being taken from them. And it's just heartbreaking watching them the Nazis confiscate everything in their houses. They just watch and they can't do anything. And so in a lot of ways, I think this is it's, you know, obviously fictionalized. But it's the only movie that really delves deep enough into the Holocaust, but at the same time, it doesn't try to be too dark. Obviously, this is not Schindler's List. But it doesn't, it's one of those movies that doesn't get a lot of recognition because it's technically a remake and not an original movie of his, but it's just such a great movie. So let's see, we've talked about the producers, we talked about 12 Chairs. We don't need to talk about Hotel Transylvania.
Yeah, we don't need to talk about the Dracula film. Let's hold off Blazing Saddles for a little bit.
And then
that's the one where I'm really going to talk about. That and Silent Movie are the two big ones I'm going to talk about.
Well, let's talk about Silent Movie. I'll let you.
All right. So per the book, only Mel Brooks would tell his laugh pack tale about a silent movie as a silent movie. With one word of dialogue throughout the film, I'll let you guess who it is once I start naming off some of the people. Joining him in his outrageous nonstop parade of sight gags are Marty Feldman, Dom DeLuise, Sid Caesar, Harold Gould, Bernadette Peters, and Ron Carey as the ruthless conglomerate engulf and devour targets a floundering movie studio. Has been director Mel Fun, who is played by Brooks, convinces the paranoid studio chief, played by Caesar, to make a star-studded silent picture. Aided by his sidekicks, DeLuise and Feldman, the devious Fun actually manages to sign some of the biggest names in Hollywood. Paul Newman, Liza Minnelli, Burt Reynolds, Anne Bancroft, James Caan, Marcel Marceau, filled with hilarious spoofs of just about everything that happens in Tinseltown, Silent Movie is one of Brooks' funniest, most original films. Who had the one line of dialogue? Don't look it up. Just guess. Out of Newman, Minnelli, Reynolds, Bancroft, Caan, and Marcel, the infamous mime, Marcel.
I don't know the answer to this. Let's see. I'm looking at the cast. I'm not cheating. Was it Dom DeLuise?
No.
Marty Feldman?
No, it's not. It's the Hollywood stars.
Was it Paul Newman?
Nope. Although his scene was amazing, though.
Burt Reynolds?
Nope.
Liza Minnelli?
Nope.
Anne Bancroft?
Nope.
Marcel Marceau?
Yep.
What was the line?
No.
Classic.
The mime had the line of dialogue in the film. Also, interesting fact, just like how in the movie, the silent film saves the studio, this movie really did save Warner Brothers because they were actually desperate for a new hit, and this was it.
Oh, that's adorable.
So it's actually one of those funny little tidbits where art is literally imitating life, and life was imitating art.
That is pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I personally enjoy silent movie because it's so different. And it also proves the point that you don't have to say anything sometimes to be funny.
This is fact.
Like, the last silent movie to come out, I believe, was The Artist.
This is fact.
And that was a drama. It wasn't a comedy. And, like, I would really love to see silent movie, not necessarily remade, but some iteration of it to come out in today's era. But the problem is that unless you're into that type of comedy like I am, it's probably not going to do well in today's box office.
Sadly not.
Nope.
But there is one thing that we do need to talk about before I move on to the movies, and it's that Mel Brooks had this habit of reusing actors all the time.
So, well, yeah, you use your band of misfits.
Exactly. So Madeline Kahn appeared in History of the World Part 1. She appeared in
Young Frankenstein, Blazing Saddles,
High Anxiety.
She's in History of the World Part 1 and To Be or Not to Be, maybe, I believe.
I don't think she's in To Be or Not to Be. She's in Blazing Saddles, though.
Yeah.
And
Blazing Saddles was her debut.
Mm-hmm. And then you also have Marty Feldman, who played Igor in Young Frankenstein, which also starred Gene Wilder, who was then in Blazing Saddles and the original producers. And so he had his band of misfits, and he liked using them. Even Dom DeLuise's son had a small, very small background role in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yeah, he was the one, his one line, like you see him in front where Robin goes, "Lend me your ears," and everyone throws the ears at him. And then, Dom's son, his line was, "Which one's yes?"
Mm-hmm.
It was like, and then,
"Yay or nay?"
He's like, "Which one's yes?" "Yay." "Yay!" Can't go wrong with that. And Dom was in that film too.
Oh yes, he did. He was Don Giovanni from Jersey.
Yeah.
So it's I love rewatching the actors in different roles because, like, just look at Madeline Kahn. She goes from Young Frankenstein to High Anxiety to Blazing Saddles and History of the World Part 1, and she manages to be the same character but not the same character. And it's never intended for her to act like the same character, and she never acts like the same character because these are different characters. But the second you hear her, you know, like, oh man, that's Madeline Kahn. It's going to be good.
Yeah. Yep.
All right, let's talk about High Anxiety.
All right, I'm on it.
There's one actress that I did forget who was in High Anxiety. She also went on to, that is Cloris Leachman. So she also played Frau Blücher, good, no nay sounds, in Young Frankenstein. But here she plays a very, like, granted she doesn't play a much better character in High Anxiety, but Cloris Leachman plays a very weird nurse whose chest keeps shifting or something, or it was like Madonna level, like cones or something. But the plot is that Dr. Richard Thorndike, played by Mel Brooks himself, is basically dealing with anxiety and he has vertigo. But the funny thing is that so there's a lot of different spoofs that Mel Brooks does. The Producers was a spoof of the Broadway genre. and Broadway musicals. Silent Movies is a spoof of Silent Movies. Spaceballs is a spoof of Star Wars. This is a spoof of Alfred Hitchcock. And although it is not my favorite Mel Brooks film, you can tell the way that he uses some of those same Hitchcock elements in order to graft a really slightly terrifying yet otherwise enjoyable story.
Yeah, High Anxiety I've only seen once, so I can't really talk much about that one because I've only seen it the one time.
Same here. So not to diss High Anxiety too much, but let's see. Let's talk about Young Frankenstein because we've mentioned it like five times already.
It's a great movie.
It came out the same year as Blazing Saddles, and we'll talk about Blazing Saddles at the end because you want us to.
Because it's the best. There's an underlying topic to it.
This is also a fact.
That's going to take a lot of conversation points.
So Young Frankenstein is a spoof of I can't even classify it as a spoof of the monster movie genre. It's kind of just like another more comedic retelling of the classic Young Frankenstein story. And it's in black and white.
Interesting fact. Yes, the film is in black and white. But all the press photos, and I'm showing it to you right now.
They are not in black and white.
They're in color. All the press photos are like in color.
And going off the producers, this is also a movie that was later turned into a musical. Although I do not believe it was quite as successful, it is still equally amazing in my opinion. The songs are hilarious. And I think the interesting thing is I think the songs in Young Frankenstein are way better than the ones in the producers. But the producers overall is a better crafted show maybe, but the songs are funnier, certainly, in Young Frankenstein. But this movie's not a musical. So,
It has musical elements to it.
It does. So, we open on Dr. Frankenstein.
It's Frankenstein!
Which is indeed Frankenstein. And he is teaching about nerve impulses to his students. And his students don't really care. Like, sure, the lesson is interesting, but he's like, Dr. Frankenstein. So, like, can you tell us about your grandfather who you brought dead tissue back to life? Blah, 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 blah. He's like, my grandfather's work was doo-doo, is an exact line. And it works so well. But anyway, so his grandfather passes away and he has to go to Transylvania by train from New York. Don't question it.
Yes. I remember those days, the good old train rides to Transylvania from New York City. That makes me feel so good about myself.
So he leaves his promiscuous, yet totally not down for sex before marriage, girlfriend Madeline Kahn. Plot point for later. And so he arrives in Transylvania, or wherever the castle is supposed to be. Was it Transylvania?
Yeah. The train stop was in Transylvania, and that's where Igor met him.
So this is where he meets Igor. Again, the musical really illustrates all of these things really well. Dr. Frankenstein's frustration about his grandfather and being interested in the brain, leaving his girlfriend who doesn't want him to touch her at all in any way, shape, or form, and then his arrival and meeting of Igor. And
the female assistant, who I'm blanking the name on, because she was in the crate or the cart with him.
Her name was Inga. She was played by Terry Garr. And Cloris Leachman played Frau Blucher, who was like this housekeeper / grandpa's girlfriend. And there's
her name was mentioned, a horse.
There was a horse like radically neighing and there was lightning or something anytime somebody mentioned Frau Blucher. a lot of it at first is like, oh, I'm only here to settle my grandfather's estate. They make hump jokes. Not literal. There's a literal hump because Igor. He says, you know, I happen to be a rather brilliant surgeon. Perhaps I can help you with that hump. What hump? And the hump keeps moving.
Side to side.
And this brings me to another fun point. Some of Mel Brooks's gags carry over into other movies. The moving hump versus the moving mole on Prince John's face.
Yep.
Things like that. And
Marty Feldman's eyes.
Yes.
Because if you watch, like, if you see Marty's eyes in Young Frankenstein and then you see his eyes in Silent Movie, he brings that same gag with him, but uses it in different types of sketches that makes it, has it make sense when he does the eye bit.
And that's just, like, running gags don't always work, but Mel Brooks does them in a slightly different way. You know, this time it was a hump, this time it's a mole, or, you know, and it works. Because it's just Mel Brooks. You kind of just don't question it because genius. You
well, I think the thing with Marty and his eyes, that's just a Marty thing that he's able, he knows how to use it comedically. He knows the timing of when to use it and when not to use it. And I think that's why that is a running gag that's able to be used all the time because he knows when to do it and when not to do it.
Yes. So apparently, according to this movie, after the producers and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which is a crime that it did not do well, apparently, in the box office. Gene Wilder finally hit box office success. And then, like, this was one of the movies that, like, helped bring him over the threshold of success. And the monster, we can't not talk about the monster. Peter Boyle plays the monster. Peter Boyle is best known for his role in Everybody Loves Raymond. He plays just such a very sympathetic and sweet monster, and the gags in this movie are incredible. They really are. From the violin music to the monster himself, to the little dance routine they do to putting on the Ritz, which is just hilarious.
Here's one for you. Big name actor. Minor role in the film. Who was it that was in there?
Gene Hackman.
Yep.
Because I'm looking at it.
Oh, you cheater. Of course, when you had to get, we both.
My God, that was Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman plays the most hilarious blind guy ever.
Yeah, because he was the one that was giving the food to the monster and kept burning him and poured the soup in his lap.
Oh, so good. God, the movies are just incredible. And Young Frankenstein, like, I love the fact that it was in black and white because I think it was stayed true to, like, those classic old, like, monster movies. And it does feel that way, but it doesn't. But again, like, none of Mel Brooks' movies, no matter the subject matter, take themselves too seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what makes it work. It really does. History of the World Part 1.
Oh, gosh. I feel like we should talk about History of the World Part 1 before we talk about Blazing Saddles.
All right, Spaceballs.
Before we talk about Spaceballs. So I guess, logically speaking, the next movie that we need to talk about is Robin Hood, Men in Tights.
We're men in tights. I love it when the cosplayers come to cons and there's like a group of them and they start singing that at cons. Like, that is like every year it happens and I see the videos on Facebook. It's like an instant share on Facebook.
Well, at the comic book convention that you and I both went to, there was a group, because Cary Elwes was there, who was just, oh, so handsome. Oh my goodness, so handsome. There was a group of cosplayers that was in the photo line before me.
And yep, I saw them. Yeah.
So they literally did the whole group. There was Maid Marian, Robin Hood, and they had a little Frau Blücher dressed as, like, the baby, which was really cute. And then you had the rest of the merry men. So you had Little John, you had Will Scarlet. You had
the whole gang.
You had the whole gang. And Blinken, of course. And it was really great. Cary Elwes loved it. And
hey, Blinken! Abe Lincoln? No, I said, hey, Blinken.
A Jew? Here?
Sorry, you set me up for the Blinken one.
No, that was a good joke. I can see. Nope.
No. What it was is that, like, I can see. Walls.
Hey, Ben.
No, I can't.
Well, no, first he falls and he goes, I can see. And then he walks into a tree.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He walks into the tree. He goes, nope. No, I can't.
And although this movie is not a musical, I think out of the non-musicals, it has the most musical numbers.
Well, yeah, it has when you first met Maid Marian.
No, hold on. You're getting ahead. So first there was the rap song.
Yeah, the rap group. Beginning.
Then you have the Maid Marian song.
Yep.
Then you have the Men in Tights song. And then
wasn't there a rap before that?
There's one at the beginning and one at the end of the movie.
I thought there was one in the middle too. I'm pretty sure there's three raps.
I think there's only two.
I think there's a third one because they're preluding into something.
Maybe. And then there's also the song that Robin sings to Maid Marian.
Yep.
Where all the other merry men are just like all the other like soldiers.
And they're behind the curtain and Robin's sword gets into a compromised position.
It's an Everlast. I don't want to say problems, but it had a few issues where Richard Lewis actually was injured. So they had to like literally break him out of the hospital at one point.
Oops. And actually, talking about running gags, it's also a gag that was brought back from History of the World Part 1.
Which one?
Patrick Stewart. It's good to be the king.
It's good to be the king.
Yeah. But the first time, though, and Mel Brooks is ironically the one who said it both times, in both History of the World Part 1 and but it was under different circumstances of why the line was said.
So there is one scene in this movie, this is a trivia question for you now, that was completely improvised between two characters. Which scene was it?
Oh, man. I think it was the fight scene with Little John.
Nope.
Oh, it was either that or I was thinking when Robin first met the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Nope, it's actually when the sheriff falls through the roof of Latrine, played by Tracy Ullman's like.
Oh, yeah.
And she tries to like get him to have sex with her. Apparently that was completely improvised. And this is, again, this is another spoof movie because it makes fun of the entire Robin Hood genre to the point of like, literally they break the fourth wall and Cary Elwes' character looks into the camera and says, unlike some other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent, which is a direct attack on Kevin Costner's Robin Hood. Well,
you want to know something really interesting?
Yeah.
Originally, this Robin Hood was supposed to come out a few years earlier. But the reason it couldn't was because of the Kevin Costner Robin Hood film. So
thanks, Kevin Costner.
Well, actually, it's interesting. If I had the bigger collector's edition where I had the big book where it has more details than what this little pamphlet has for me, it actually talks about a lot of the more inner workings of it. And they openly said, yeah, they had actually started working on a script, like, I guess, or at least a concept. And then it was announced that Kevin Costner was doing his Robin Hood, so they actually had to shelve the story. And then once there is a amount of time that had to pass before it was allowed to be touched again. Mm-hmm. Once that time lapsed, Mel Brooks was able to get back into doing that story because he really wanted to do Robin Hood. Like that was a project he really wanted to do. And that's why you saw a lot of the stuff from the Kevin Costner. There's a lot of stuff from Kevin Costner, but there's also a lot of stuff from the much older Robin Hood films as well. Like obviously the fight
scene. Errol Flynn Robin Hood.
Exactly that one. Like the fight scene between Robin and Little John on the bridge. That's obviously from Costner. The line about, you know, unlike other, you know, Robin Hood.
Don't forget Sir Patrick Stewart's Scottish accent. That was a direct reference to Sean Connery.
Yep. But like the line about like, unlike other Robin Hoods, I can speak with an English accent. You know, that wasn't just a shot at Costner. That was also a shot at the other guy too. You know, that was a shot at everybody who's ever played Robin Hood. So, you know, so like there's a lot of elements, like, so they ended up adding elements from Kevin Costner's film into it, even though the original intent was. So,
let's get into this movie. It opens in Jerusalem during the Crusades, where Robin Hood meets a sneeze, father of a chew. A chew, played by Dave Chappelle. And this was actually Dave Chappelle's first, like, movie role.
And he did a great job.
Oh my God. It was great. Chu is like, honestly, this is one of those movies where you don't have a least favorite character. Because every single character is just so insane and hilarious and amazing in their own ways that you just can't hate on any of them.
Tracy Ullman as Latrine going, I touched it. I touched it. You know,
this was that close. Tracy Ullman's entire like performance as Latrine, which was changed in the 9th century. Their name was changed in the 9th century. And it's hilarious because there's just so many gags in this movie. But anyway, so Robin comes home, or he swims home, and England apparently has a big Hollywood sign. It stole it. And he...
Well, no, it said England, though.
I know.
Yeah.
And so he goes to his old mansion, which is literally being taken away by tax collectors, essentially.
With Blinken on the toilet.
With blanket on the toilet, because I thought it felt a bit drafty.
Oh no, the best part is like even before that, you know, he's like, Robin, it's like, oh my God,
The best part about that scene is the fact that he's reading a Braille version of Playboy magazine.
Yeah, but then he gets like, it's like he hears Robin. He's like, Master Robin, and he grabs a statue that has no arms, like, oh my God, your arms are gone. But you grew some really nice boobs. So it's like, Blinken, I'm over here.
It's like, it's priceless. Blinken is such a funny character. But they're all incredible. So basically throughout the adventure, first he meets up with a Chew, bless you. And then you have that line of, a Chew here? And there's a lot of like physical humor, like when they meet, when he says, watch my back, and a Chew tells him, your back was just punched twice. Thank you. Then they like kick their butts and.
I like the part with the sneakers.
There's a lot of literal humor in this movie. Like, why don't we fox them? There's a literal fox. I think the.
Which is also titled 20th or like 16th century fox.
Yes, it was. And then I think Roger Reese's like speech impediment as the sheriff of Rottingham was hilarious because he would just mix up words and then
you dare to kill a king's dare.
Yeah.
What?
Don't you know? Well, oh God, I can't do it justice.
I like the best one where he goes, it's just everything is nothing in order. And it's like, it is illegal to do.
Don't you know? It is illegal.
Oh no, that's what it was. It was the boar. That's yeah, what it was. The when boar. The boar was run. It's like it's boar illegal to. It is illegal to kill a boar in the king's lands. I'm like
forest.
The forest is like, but everyone's just going like, bro, what the hell did you just say? Like, I think you need Hooked on Phonics or something. You know?
There's just two... Oh, this is an interesting trivia that I just found out. So when Dirty Ezio sets himself up in the tower to assassinate Robin Hood during the archery contest, a sign can be seen behind him that reads, Royal Folio Depository. Oh my God, how have I never noticed that?
I've noticed that before.
So the funny thing is that this is obviously an allusion to the Texas Book Depository building from which allegedly shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Just kidding. Allegedly.
But actually, the best part of that is like, yeah, he's up in that depository and then Blinken catches the arrow. And he's like, I heard that from a mile away. He's like, all right, let's go, guys. Like, what did he say?
Who said that? Who's talking?
And they're standing like right next to him.
And like all good Mel Brooks films, there's so much fourth wall breaking. There's looking directly at the camera. They literally pull out the script to make sure that Robin has a second shot. And there's also a scene where like the camera accidentally like breaks through the window when Maid Marian is in the bath.
Doing her number when we were introduced to her.
Oh my God.
Oh, and then there's the part where Robin and Sheriff of Nottingham, Mervyn, are having their duel for Maid Marian, mm-hmm. and the sword goes through and it takes the guy's hot dog.
Yep.
And then he gives them the hot dog back. Oh, the best one is, like, also during the same fight, is, like, in the beginning part of the fight, they're actually speaking what the fight choreography is. Parry, 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 lunge, good!
And it's actually one of the things that, so Mel Brooks loved talking about Cary Elwes in the role and how much he loved him, partially not just because he's a fabulous actor, but because of The Princess Bride, he already had sword fighting training. So all he had to do was learn the choreography, which saved them a lot of time.
Yeah. That's always a help, but yet again, I know this from going to acting school and stuff like that. One of the things that they've always said is that if you really want to take yourself seriously as an actor, go to combat school. Learn to fight, learn to do sword fighting, learn to do the hand-to-hand combat, learn to do that stuff. Because if you can learn how to do that stuff, that ups your stock as an actor. So it is important. So.
Oh God, there's just too many things to say about this movie. And I think there is one character we have overlooked. Very important character, and it's not Will Scarlett O'Hara, although he's important, or Little John. It is Rabbi Tuckman.
Oh, yes. Fagulas?
No, they're straight. Just married. those that are not Jewish, Fagulas imply, I mean, probably people figured it out in you, but implies some homosexuality in there. But no, they're straight, just married. No, I think the best gag, though, is when they ask him what circumcision is, and Little John's like, oh, I'll take two. Just think about how two circumcisions would work. Dumb. So he says, no, it's easy. He pulls out a carrot and a little mini handheld guillotine. He says, I take a little thing, I put it into my little machine here, and nip the tip.
Everyone's like, oh, God.
And obviously, Achu, who is now a foreign exchange student in England, but is from Jerusalem, says, I forgot, I already got one. And this look on Dave Chappelle is like an incredible comedian, first of all. But I love not just, there's a few comedians who can pull off not just the jokes and the gags, but the physical aspects of comedy. And one of those things is facial expressions. Like Robin Williams was great at this. And Dave Chappelle's amazing at this. So you just see that look on his face like, yep, I'm familiar with this.
I like Little John's reaction. Like he just like you can see most of the merry men just like go putting their hands over their groins and go like, oh God, maybe never mind. And then actually much later when Maid Marian and Robin Hood get married, spoiler alert, you know, Rabbi Tuckman is actually in the middle of doing a circumcision.
He says, hold on, I'm on my last customer. You hear the snip, goes, put some ice on it.
And I can say this as a circumcised man. It was done to me as a baby, so I don't know if it hurt.
Well, this guy definitely did.
Yeah.
And
like a perfect setup for you right there.
This movie is just so funny, and it's of course, unlike with as with a lot of movies, there's a setup for sequels that never happen, but. You know, at the end, these African-American merry men are singing, and then we'll meet again in Robin Hood 2. There is no Robin Hood 2.
There's no Spaceballs 2.
There's no History of the World Part 2.
Mel Brooks has said he wants to do Spaceballs 2.
Wants to, will do, God willing. But
well, apparently he's been wanting to do the sequel to Spaceballs for, like, the last few years.
I know.
But I think Disney's blocking it.
But first of all, it's a spoof, so Disney can just suck it, but...
Well, no, because...
There is another issue, though. Who do you get to replace John Candy and Joan Rivers?
That's a great question. Honestly, that's kind of stuff that you... that's stuff that you can take care of in the film, like in the beginning of the film and stuff like that. Because we've seen it before with other films. Like, we're going to see it next year with Bill and Ted 3 with George Carlin not being there as Rufus.
I mean, he was killed in the last previous movie, wasn't he, anyway?
No, he was still alive. Because...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, Rufus was still alive last time I remember. He
was killed in the second one.
Yeah, but they can bring him back. It's okay.
Okay.
But they openly said in the script there's a tribute to Rufus.
Nice.
Three. So there's ways of explaining that type of stuff. you know, it's not that hard to do.
Well, I guess this is our perfect segue to talk about the greatest spoof of Star Wars ever. And no, it's not the Christmas special. well, it's okay. You can laugh. You can cry. It's allowed. But
I don't know. I think more people are in the fetal position on the Christmas special than anything, going, my God, why did I watch this thing?
We're saving them. So let's talk about Spaceballs.
Well, see, here's the thing. And I want to go back to a point real quick because we're on that point. The reason I think we're never going to see Spaceballs 2 is the same reason why we're not going to see any more Star Wars spoofs by Family Guy. And it's because of Disney. Because Seth MacFarlane has openly said the reason that we're most likely never going to be able to do it, although that could change now that Family Guy is under the Disney umbrella.
So weird to me, but...
Oh, yeah, a lot of things are weird with that. He openly stated that Disney would be the number one reason why we can't do it. And that was before the whole purchase of 20th Century Fox by Disney. And being how, I don't know, if Spaceballs was under 20th Century Fox, because I know some of the films were MGM and some of the films were 20th Century.
Spaceballs was MGM.
Oh, it was MGM. Then that's a harder sell with Disney. If it was under 20th Century Fox, it probably would have been an easier sell at this point. But, I mean, it just is what it is, you know?
On the other hand, this is just an excuse. If it could be sold as an excuse for Disney to make way more money on a Star Wars movie that is not a Star Wars movie, I think they would jump at the chance. But we shall see.
Mel Brooks has been wanting to do it. I say do it. Guy ain't getting any younger.
So Spaceballs is a spoof of Star Wars, but it starts in the middle of action that we don't know where, because it's not like episode one. It's like episode
17.
Something like that. And you have Planet Spaceball, which is just a spaceship because they kill their own planet and they just travel on the spaceship. And so this is another interesting moment where characters reappear, because the guy who plays the Abbot in Robin Hood Men in Tights also plays the king in Spaceballs.
Hey, Abbot!
And that man was played by Dick Van Patten.
Yep.
And so you have Rick Moranis in this movie. You have John Candy. You have Joan Rivers. This pretty much guarantees a fantastic movie. And the setup is, you know, Princess Vespa, who is a Druish princess, decides to leave her Prince Valium, not a Valium, a prince named Valium, at the altar and go off into space with her robot, Dot, voiced by Joan Rivers. Joan Rivers! Ugh. And so she gets picked up by John Candy and Bill Pullman, who plays Lone Star. John Candy is a Mog, half man, half dog, and Lone Star is like the Han Solo equivalent. And there's all these gags about, like, oh God, they're stuck with a Druish princess. And then, you know, there's a fight, there's kidnapping. Mel Brooks has two roles in this movie, just like he would in Blazing Saddles. So he plays Yogurt, not to be confused with Yoda. Completely different trademark. And this is one of those movies where, like, the random product placement I wish existed. I would want Spaceballs with a flamethrower. Come on. Kids love those. And he also plays the President Scroob, who is the head of...
the Empire, essentially.
Yeah. So then we have Darth Helmet. Dark Helmet.
Rick Moranis. Man, Rick Moranis. I love that man.
And bonus points because Michael Winslow is in this movie. And if you don't know who Michael Winslow is, this is a man who can do so many sounds with just the power of his voice. And one of the things I always remember him from is, of course, Police Academy, which is not a Mel Brooks movie, but it's just hysterical anyway. So he does a lot of the sound effects as he's playing this radar technician. So he gets a shout out for sure. So you have Rick Moranis, who likes to play with Spaceballs, the action figures. And Princess Vespa has like the deepest baritone you could ever think of. All of these characters kind of like define what we would consider to be like the typical tropes for those Star Wars characters. So Princess Vespa is very much the equivalent of Princess Leia, but she's a baritone and she's snippety and she's not quite the great general that Leia is. Dot is not as uptight and annoying as C-3PO. She's got a dirty mind and she's hilarious. There's a virgin alarm that she has. John Candy is technically the Chewbacca equivalent, but we can understand what he's saying. And there's just all these cute little things that are changed from the original Star Wars to be more spoof-like. And of course, there's plenty of fourth wall breaking to the point where they literally grab Spaceballs, the VHS tape, and play it.
Well, that's because they needed to review something of what was going on.
Right. They needed to know what planet, like, the Lone Star and his cohorts went to.
And actually, the funny thing is that you mentioned the fourth wall break of them watching the movie to see what they did previously in the film. That was also, in a way, a precursor to the Robin Hood Men in Tights with the pulling out of the script.
Yep, and Dom DeLuise is also in this movie. He's the voice of Pizza the Hutt.
Dom DeLuise is in, I think, the majority of the films. If I remember right, Dom is in 12 Chairs. I don't think he's in Blazing Saddles or Young Frankenstein, but he's in Silent Movie. I believe he's in High Anxiety. He's definitely in History of the World Part 1. I think he was in To Be or Not to Be.
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't in
Robin Hood Men in Tights, though.
Yeah, and he was also in Spaceballs. Like, he's in... Actually, hold on. I got the little card right here. 12 Chairs, definitely. That's right. He was in Blazing Saddles. He was the gay director.
Oh my god, of course!
Yeah,
Playback!
Yeah, I don't think he was in Young Frankenstein. Definitely in Silent Movie. Doesn't say for High Anxiety. Was definitely in History of the World Part 1.
So this is the disappointing thing, so...
Yeah, Dom DeLuise was in, like, the majority of the films.
So this is interesting because when they made the movie, Mel Brooks actually got permission from George Lucas to make the movie on one condition. No merchandise, which is why there's a merchandising joke in the movie.
Yeah.
Spaceballs the breakfast cereal. Spaceballs the flamethrower.
And I think that was kind of the agreement, was like, all right, we can't make merchandise for it, but you're going to allow us to make fun of that fact. And I bet you they showed it to George first to get the approval to put that in the film. Because you're obviously not going to, you're getting the permission to do this thing. You're not going to want to piss the guy off.
And I was right. Michael Winslow did most of the sound effects. That's just the one for the scene he was in. He did all of them. Or most of them, anyway. In the DVD audio commentary, Mel Brooks apparently makes a joke that they saved around $1,000 by just letting Michael Winslow do it. And Rick Moranis is just like the nerdiest yet like completely unintimidating Lord Helmet, but it's so funny.
He's so adorable.
Because that's what Mel does best. He like circumvents our expectations of what a character is supposed to be. And
I wish he would come back to acting, but I understand why.
It's the same way that, like, people wish Gene Wilder would come back, but he never did.
Well, I think at a certain point, because if I remember right, Gene Wilder also had dementia or Alzheimer's, one of the two, if I remember right. You're on the computer, so you can look it up. he had something, and that's why he...
He quit acting because his wife died.
Well, yeah, but... But there also comes a point, well, no, that's why Rick Moranis quit acting. Rick Moranis quit acting because his wife died and his children were young. So he...
They both basically left for some reason, but you're right. Gene Wilder did have Alzheimer's. He had kept knowledge of his condition private, but had been diagnosed 3 years prior to his death.
Yeah, and he, yeah, so it's like for him, he had his health issues. So I can see why Wilder never came back. Whereas Moranis, while his wife died, he had young children. So he quit acting to take care of his kids. And but in the meantime, he also put out a couple country albums. And he did a little bit of voice acting because he didn't really have to be on a set for like months on end away from his kids. It's like he did the Brother Bear movies.
Oh my gosh, he did. I forgot about those.
And those were like the last films that he did outside of a couple little things here or there. I think the last thing he did was in 2012, which was like an anniversary thing to something he used to do on whatever the Canadian equivalent of Second City was. Or it might have been Second City. But I know that with Ghostbusters 3 coming out, the Reitman film, there's talk about, like, could we be getting, because Sigourney Weaver's coming back, Bill Murray's coming back, Hutz, you know, there's a hope there's a hope that Rick Moranis will come back, but he has openly stated, I'm only going to come back if the script makes sense for me to come back. He's just not going to do it for this.
That's good. I'm glad. I hope he does.
Because like we remember him as this amazing actor who had great comedic timing and stuff like that. And for him to come back and have a dud film, that's the last thing you're going to remember him for. So I understand why he has the stance he has.
All right. We can talk about it now. Let's talk about the most hysterical... let's talk about the most hysterical movie, I think...
Film Institute's Top 100 Comedy.
History of the World, Part 1.
Oh, wait, hold on. I think that's also one of them. I thought we were talking about Blazing Saddles. We've skipped around so many movies.
We cannot skip History of the World, Part 1. It is a crime.
Now, let me read this. Mel Brooks's uproarious version of history proves that nothing is sacred as he takes us on a laugh-filled look at what really happened throughout time. His delirious romp features everything from a wild send-up of the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, to the real stories behind the Roman Empire. Brooks portrays a stand-up philosopher at Caesar's Palace. The French Revolution, where Brooks reigns as King Louis XIV, or 16th, and the Spanish Inquisition, a splashy song and dance number with monks and swimming nuns. It's Mel and company at their hilarious best. And remember from what we've learned from Monty Python, nobody ever expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Oh, God. I don't know where to start with this film. Because it opens on, like, this narration, and you have a couple of scenes of, like, the first thing that man discovered after they started to walk, and I'm not going to reveal what that is.
It started in the caves, like the nomads.
Well, it starts before the caves. There's like this little narration of the sun rising and how, you know, the man became man. And then it does the cave thing of like this weird documentary thing and how the first song was born. And then it goes through Mel plays Moses as he brings down the 10 commandments for all to obey. And he makes a second appearance as Moses, weirdly enough, during the chase from the Roman Empire. because it's, he's, or the Moses equivalent or descendant of Moses is being robbed, essentially. But then, so it goes through the entrance of the Ten Commandments, and then it moves to Greek and or ancient Rome, where we meet Comicus, a stand-up philosopher, and one of the Golden Girls. Who was it? Gonna look it up really quick, but he plays this woman at the unemployment agency. And so there's a gladiator in front of the line from him. It was B. Arthur. And she says, okay, did you kill someone last week? No. Did you try to kill last week? Yes. He goes, okay. So this is your last week of unemployment. If you don't kill anybody next week, we have to change your status. But then Comicus comes up. It says occupation. Stand-up philosopher. She looks at him like he's crazy, like, what? He goes, I coalesce the vapor of human blah, 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 blah. She looks at him. She goes, oh, a bullshit artist. So then goes through the whole thing, but continue calling him a bullshit artist. So did you bullshit last week? Did you try to bullshit last week? Great. And so it goes through those motions. And then he gets a job. And he's playing Caesar's Palace, literally and figuratively.
If I remember right, they gave it the Vegas feel too.
Yes, they did. There's a whole thing when they're like driving up and it's in Caesar's Palace. And Dom DeLuise plays Julius Caesar. And Madeline Kine plays Empress Nympho. And there's so many, I think this is the movie that has the most sex jokes. I don't know why this is the movie that has the most sex jokes, but I think this is it.
Because based off of Roman culture?
That would explain a lot.
Yeah, because I know, like, if you watch the show Spartacus on Stars, there's a lot of sex and orgies and stuff like that. And it's just because that's how the culture was.
Makes me glad I wasn't alive back then. Anyway, so Comicus makes a faux pas, shall we say. And coincidentally ends up calling Caesar fat. And so he is then on the run with his, you know, his manager, Swiftus, and let's not forget, oh, what was his name? Oh, no, who was it? Josephus. Gregory Hines plays Josephus. And the scene where they find Josephus is just, it's hysterical because he's it's a slave auction. And I know there's nothing funny about a slave auction, but this is hysterical. Because he's trying to convince them not to throw him to the lions. He goes, I know for a fact that the lions only eat Christians. And me, I'm a Jewish person. And he's black, and the guy doesn't believe him. So he goes, so he starts doing a little dance and goes, Hava, Megila, Hava, he goes, no, I'm Jewish. So, you know, how does one check if you're Jewish? So he pulls open his pants. He goes, Jewish, huh? He missed. It was his first day on the job. He was really nervous. I have an appointment for next Thursday. Come in. They give me a local. He was funny. And I think that's what drew Comicus and Swiftus to them. And so they go through the motions of escaping through ancient Rome. And there's more thing about Empress Nympho and the virgins and Empress Nympho picking out her midnight escort. And then it transitions to them in Jerusalem or in Judea, and they all get jobs in this little inn, and they have to go and serve this really big party. It's the Last Supper, so you know who's there. And Da Vinci walks in and says, oh, this is not good. All I have is a box. Then it goes through the very hilarious musical number of the Inquisition. And then it ends with the French Revolution, where it kind of does like the Prince and the Pauper / the Man in the Iron Mask / its own version of both of those things in a story about the French Revolution. And it works. And Claude, and there is, of course, what was his name? Claude de Monet. Count de Monet. Count de Money. Played by Harvey Korman, who, of course, plays
Hedley Lamarr.
He does play Hedley Lamarr. Not to be confused with Hedy Lamarr, who is wonderful and sued and won and was right. So Hedy, the same thing with Count de Money versus Count de Monet being a running gag in Blazing Saddles, that you have another running gag of it's not, you know, Hedy Lamarr, it's Hedley Lamarr. Yeah. And Hedy Lamarr did not appreciate that and sued. And Mel Brooks pretty much acted like it was the best money he ever spent. And so both of these movies are, as we kind of slowly transition into talking about Blazing Saddles, these are movies you cannot make today.
Fortunately not. Like,
you got, you know, you'll have the far right Christians screaming down your neck. You'll have the far left SJWs coming at you with torches and pitchforks. And both will be calling you every sellout and evil name in the book that exists.
It's just the society. And it's funny. This is my second recording consecutively. Because I was recording one of my other podcasts before this. And we were talking about that, but in reference to women's hockey. Because there's just so, like, this society has so much negativity in it now that we can't look at any positive stuff. There's no positive mental attitude towards anything. It's just, it's this or it's this. No matter what, you're wrong. And there's just this negative outlook on everything.
And this kind of goes back to what Max Brooks said at his panel at AwesomeCon, which was that, like, comedy is really needed, and comedy is needed now more often than ever, and comedy has to be able to be free to be comedy. Now, obviously, we're not talking about, like, rape jokes or, like, blatant racist jokes, but we are talking about being able to make fun of everything and everyone equally. And I think, like, as a society, we just kind of forgotten that, like, it's okay to be a little bit offended. Like, it's okay. The world is not going to swallow you whole if you're a little bit offended.
Do you know when a lot of the political correctness came in the comedy?
When?
When George Carlin died.
Fact. There's this Australian comedian. I think he's Australian or New Zealand comedian who talked about being offended and how, like, it was. He actually has, like, a really funny skit where he, like, a little bit where he talks about, like, the power of being offended. He goes, you know, what offends you might not offend me. And he says, okay, like, I'm personally offended by boy bands. It's like, what do I do then? Do I report it? Like, and he goes, they're on the telly again. Yeah, there's five of them. And it's true. And so, like, I think a lot of people miss the point with these movies is that they're not intended to be racist or whatever it is that they're doing. It's intended to poke fun of racism. Because if you look at Blazing Saddles, every racist person in the movie is stupid.
Yeah.
They're completely dumb and horrible people. And it's never, ever pretended otherwise.
Like at the very beginning of the movie, when you're introduced to Cleavon Little's character, and you got the cowboys, you know, who are watching over the black slaves and the Irish and the...
They're not slaves. They're just... Oh, they're basically slaves.
Yeah, they're basically like slaves, but they're the railroad workers. Like, you had the overseers, and they're like, come on, sing us a song. N-word. I'm not going to say the word, but an N-word song. Slave,
you sang like birds. Yep.
And it's like, first they get a little offended. They're like, oh, the N-word just got thrown. And they're like, no, we got this. And then Cleavon Little goes, I get no kick from champagne. And then they just go into that number, and they're like, hold it, what is this horse shit, you know? And then they're just like, no, we want an N-word song, you know, like Sweet Low.
We want a song, a real song, yeah, like Camp Town Ladies. And they both
Well, before they get to that, it was like Sweet Low, Sweet Chariot. I was like, yeah, you don't know that one, dude. Well, how about the Camp Town Lady? Cleavon Little goes, the Camp Town Lady. And the guy's like, yeah, the Camp Town Lady. Is like, then they start going into it, then all the guys who are, like, essentially racist towards the other group, the railroad workers, are dancing around like a bunch of jackasses singing the song, you know? But you can't do that today because people would be just too easily offended by it. But that's the point of the joke.
I mean, I think this is perfectly illustrated when, so plot-wise, Headley wants to build a railroad, and he wants it to go through this town of Rock Ridge, but there's one thing in his way.
The town. Right.
Yeah. So he just, and they've recently just lost their sheriff, so he decides that the perfect thing to do is to get a black sheriff to sabotage the town and whatnot. So he goes to the racist mayor, played by Mel Brooks.
Well, we don't know officially if the mayor's racist.
This is true. But it's 1878. They're all racist. And he's kind of... He's not racist, but he's also not... So they get Cleavon Little, who was sentenced to be hung, and the hangman is the same one from Robin Hood Men in Tights. So he doesn't get hanged. and he gets assigned to be the new sheriff of Rockridge. So he arrives into town, and because they're so excited to hear the sheriff and there's bells ringing, nobody hears the one person in the background saying the sheriff is black. Darcy doesn't use that.
Oh, yeah. The sheriff is, and then the bell knocks out the N-word beautifully.
And so he gets there, and they all pull out his guns, and he says, okay, this is the, you know, the William J. LePetitmane. I am the new sheriff of Rockridge. And they all have their guns pointed to him. And so he pretends that he's holding himself hostage, and they all buy it. I don't know how or why. But as he closes the door on his sheriff office, he goes, oh, baby, you are so talented. And they are so dumb.
Well, let's do a little preface, too. All the people in the town, their last name is Johnson.
This is true. Howard Johnson.
Ron Johnson.
Johnson & Johnson.
Yeah.
They're all Johnsons. So then you have the introduction of Gene Wilder's character, who is...
The Waco Kid.
Huh?
The Waco Kid.
The Waco Kid, like this great...
The fastest gun shooter in the West.
Shot in the West, exactly. But he's kind of a drunk. And so the two meet, and they play chess, and they tell them each other's stories. And Cleavon Little's character tells the story of how he and his parents were heading west, and they get stopped by a group of Native Americans.
And, of course, you have the wagon circle with the main group, and Cleavon...
Because the white folks wouldn't let them circle with their wagons.
So they had the circle themselves, which looked hilarious sped up on film.
Yes, it did. So they are met with the chief,
played by Mel Brooks.
And he speaks Yiddish. So the Native Americans out west speak Yiddish. And for those that don't speak Yiddish, the basic story is, oh, let them go. Like, you're good. It's all fine. You can go now. And everybody says, you know, the parents and the kid says, thank you. And they're free to go.
After they leave.
They're darker than us.
Yeah. It was like, after they leave, it was like, woof, they darker than us. And then they like look at each other like, what the hell?
And so I
actually, one of the scenes when it finally came to television back in the 70s, because it came out in 74,
mm-hmm.
The same year as Young Frankenstein, one scene was heavily edited on the audio.
Is it the scene where him and Madeline Kahn?
Nope.
Which one?
The campfire scene where they're all eating the baked beans farting.
Oh, yeah, because fun fact, this is the first movie to have an actual fart scene.
Yes, and all the flatulence was actually edited out of the TV version. So when you watch it and you see guys, you know, and obviously you and I were on camera, people aren't seeing us, but when, you know, I get up and I had to like lift my leg and I let one rip, you know, when you do that without the sound, it doesn't have the same effect. And that was like a big thing because, like, you know, they're like, oh, well, you can't show off flatulence. Why? Everybody does it.
And yet they did. So, yeah.
Eventually the flatulence was allowed on television. I think it wasn't allowed until, like, I think the 80s, maybe.
Well, point being, this is the first official movie to have a fart sound.
Yeah. It's
pretty epic. But
multiple ones at that.
So there's this whole thing with, you know, the sheriff going out trying to be nice to the people and meet them, and it doesn't work. And he's feeling down, and like he helps a little old lady, and she goes from beating. So the thugs, who the same people that like run the railroad for Hedley Lamarr.
Basically, it's Hedley.
Like, do like a whole thing in the town. They're like breaking windows, raping cattle. They're doing all sorts of horrible things.
Man, those cattle really had it coming.
The sheriff saves this little lady from getting beat up or something. Or no, I'm sorry. Before all of this, he like walks down. And
No. The beat up was before he was even there.
That's true.
Yeah, no, what it was is that he was walking around.
Yes.
And he was trying to like meet the people, and he goes, good morning, ma'am. And she just was up yours N-word. And then, and this is where the camp scene or the campfire scene with the flashlights came in.
Because
they brought in Mongo.
But before that, there's the scene where the sheriff comes back, and Gene Wilder's character is consoling him. He goes, what did you think they were going to say? You know, say thank you, marry my daughter. You know, these are simple farmers, the people of the land, the common clay of the West. You know, morons.
Yeah. And then he takes care of Mongo, which then leads to that elderly woman to come back to offer a pie.
But then she says, you'll have the good decency not to mention any...
Well, she comes back to say that part.
Yes, but she still have it.
Yeah. And actually, one of the best things is when Lamar sends in the request to release Mongo. And they release him, and then, like, Mongo just breaks out of the chains. And they're like, why didn't you just do that before?
Goes, Mongo life, Sheriff Bart. Sheriff Bart, basically, like, there's great friendship.
Sheriff Bart, only man to eat Mongo. And then, so they asked him, like, so...
Mongo have deep feelings for Sheriff Bart, yeah.
But then the thing was, is I was like, oh, so Mongo, what would Lamar want to do with the town of Rockridge? And he goes, something to do with choo-choo. You know, obviously the train. He's like, well, what about the choo-choo? And he goes, Mongo goes, and I'll tell you who wrote this line. Mongo goes, Mongo don't know. Mongo just pawn.
Pawn in Game of Life.
Who wrote that line?
I don't know who.
It's the only line he wrote for the entire film. Richard Pryor.
Oh my God, of course it was Richard Pryor.
That was the only line that Richard Pryor wrote for the entire movie.
There's also like a little Looney Tune gag with how Sheriff Bart defeats Mongo, which is really great. But candy grand for Mongo. But anyway, so they go to see Madeline Kahn, who is a burlesque like performer, and she sings a song about
I'm tired.
How she's tired of love, uninspired. And she's actually a plot sent by Lamar to weaken Sheriff Bart because, you know, no one can resist her. Well, Sheriff Bart manages to not resist her, but he doesn't exactly fall under her spell. And that's a scene that shouldn't be spoiled. But the thing is that Headley is annoyed that it didn't work. So he's like, okay, I need all the ruffians, the worst thugs, burglars, bad guys, like the worst people you could think of. And so they all line up, like in a bread line. You've got, you know, your typical thugs. You've got some Mexican, like, bad guys.
Riders, yeah.
You have bikers.
The Ku Klux Klan, Nazis.
You got everybody.
Yeah, you got everybody.
And, of course, you know, they got a, you know, Gene Wilder and the two characters with a Waco kid and Sheriff Bart decide that they have to check out what's going on. Now, the best part about this is the KKK guys, they're wearing their white robes, and on the back, there's a happy smiley face that says, have a nice day. And so they play a joke and get these two KKK guys and obviously beat the crap out of them so that they could take their hoods.
The appropriate lines is, oh, boys, look what I have over here.
Yeah.
Hey, where all the white women at? Ku Klux Klan comes behind the rock. Boom, they come out.
So
and they get up to the front.
And, like, none of this really, like, they figure out what the plan is, but then they still have to figure out, like, how do they stop Headley Lamar? They decide, so first of all, the fourth wall is already broken with the fact that, like, you've got, you know, all of these, like, you got, like, the KKK and, like, the Nazis right there, like, ready to fight to take Rock Ridge.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that that's fourth wall. I would just put it more as a gag because the real fourth wall is...
That's true. That comes later. You're right.
Is when they Hollywood the town.
True. So they... Bart sees his old friend who still works at on the railroad, and they figure out what the plan is. And so they bring the plan to the citizens of Rock Ridge, and they're like, no, we don't want, like, you know, all these people want...
Well, the original thing was like, oh, yeah, we'll do it with the N-words and the C-words, the black people and the Chinese, but not the Irish.
No, want the Irish. And then eventually they relent. The funny thing is like, when he says, we don't want the Irish, it's like, that's a complete deal breaker. No. We can't do it without the Irish. So it's like, okay, oh, prairie shit, we'll take them all.
Yeah.
And so they build a fake town of Rock Ridge.
They literally do the Hollywood set of Rock Ridge.
And this leads to the fourth wall breaking, because eventually the fighting spills out of the set, literally. And they do try to delay the bad guys. They put a toll booth, which is the greatest gag ever.
Well, that's because they forgot to put the people in the town, and that's why they put up the toll booth.
Hey, it worked, didn't it? So then you have like...
Come back and get me a shitload of dimes.
So then they end up breaking into where Dom DeLuise's cameo goes into, where he's filming a little musical. Weird little...
Like, it's a dance number.
It's a dance number with a bunch of gay men, and...
That fight scene is the best fight scene out of all fight scenes.
It really is. He goes...
Because it's like... It's like, this is a closed set! It's like, screw you, I work for Mel Brooks. And it's like, not the face. Punches him in the gut. And then one of the, and it's like, thank you. And it's like one of the other gay men on stage goes, he just hit Buddy. Let's get him, girls. And like, you just see this like one dude.
He's like, oh,
ran out of water. And he's just battering his palm fist.
And then he starts crying and there's hugging and like
and then they like they walk through like the one thing under the stairwell and like they're fighting going into it, and then they like the arms over like the big brute guy cowboy has his arm over the dancer and it's like, well, I'm actually parked out over here in this parking lot over here, and it's like, what the hell. Sorry, I just get really into Blazing Saddles.
No, it's an amazing movie. There's another Hitler gag in there where they like go into the cafeteria.
Yep.
And there's a little scene before that where Hitler's talking, an actor playing Hitler's, you know, talking to somebody else. He goes, ugh. And the guy asks, like, how much time you got left? He goes, they lose me right after the bunker scene. And then you've got, like, tourists. And then, like, this movie would be accused of racism, sexism, homophobia, so many other isms and phobias and things that like I can't even name, but
and that brings us to the major point of why we saved this for last,
because this movie is insane and it's incredible.
But the thing is though, is that you know how movies are getting re-released in theaters, right? Like they're getting those Fathom event re-releases, like a temporary time. This is the one that you can never do.
Nope. Torches and Pitchforks.
Yeah, you can never do it, which is a damn shame. And the funny thing is that the majority of those people with the torches and pitchforks that you mentioned are the people who grew up with this movie.
Now, well,
yeah.
Part of it would be those guys, but the other part would be like, you know, the SJW millennial, like...
Well, that also brings up a funny point. For a generation that grew up on Family Guy and South Park, how the hell are you offended by anything?
I mean, there are people that are literally offended by everything.
But how, when you grew up and were raised with South Park and Family Guy?
Just because those things exist does not mean that medium was consumed.
Yeah.
And plenty of people will also say that Family Guy and The Simpsons and Futurama are offensive and vile and should never be made and things like that. They're wrong, but details. Yeah. So the reason that I think that's like one of the main reasons we saved this for last, but also because this movie is just so insane. And it also has a plethora of lovely musical numbers.
Yeah. I'm Tired. I'm Tired is the number one one that comes to mind.
Well, there's also the
Rockridge sign.
The Rockridge song. There was a peaceful town of Rockridge. They also have the one that they sing at church where it ends with our town is turning into shit.
That's the Rockridge song.
Is it though?
Yeah, it is.
It's like a reprise song.
Yeah, it's the Rockridge song because it starts outside the town and then ends in the church.
We'll call it a reprise.
Yeah.
And then you have the song at the beginning. He rode a blazing saddle, he wore a shining star.
And then you had the musical when Cleavon Little was riding the horse into town.
Yeah.
And then you have the piano player just out there in the middle of the desert. Yep. And they do like the high five thing. I'm like, where the hell have you come from? You know?
There's just, like, basically the entire end of the movie is a giant fourth wall break, but it's a literal fourth wall break because they literally break a wall. Several walls, probably.
Not only that, but the end the part that takes them into the credits is them riding on their horses.
And then getting into cars.
And then getting into a limo.
Yep.
And then also they're watching the movie in the Chinese theater.
Yep. The funny thing is Hedley Lamarr trying to get into the theater with a student ID. He goes, student, are you kidding?
Pain in the ass.
He even stops to get Raisinets. Like, this is really...
And there's cows in the lobby.
Don't question it.
There's cattle in the lobby.
Don't question it. So, basic
things... I was questioning it?
Basic things to remember. Mel Brooks is an insane, brilliant, incredible genius. These movies that he's crafted are 100% timeless. They can and should be enjoyed by people of all races, creeds, and religions, who will then all be offended.
But do you know what the number one rule of comedy is?
What?
Number one rule is that nothing is sacred. Do you know what the number one thing a lot of people, number one rule is nothing is sacred when it comes to comedy. Anything, nothing is off limits. But one of the whole points of comedy, like the main point of comedy, is to offend.
I don't think that's the main point. I think the main point of comedy is to poke fun at ourselves and our society and the world that we live in.
But if you're not getting offended by something,
I don't think that's true. I really don't. I think that there's a difference between feeling a little bit offended because something is like a joke on a stereotype that's sort of true, like all of the Jewish jokes that Elon Gold makes.
I'll put it out there like this. I've seen Lewis Black live 3 times.
I don't know who that is.
Lewis Black is a Jewish comedian from Silver Spring, Maryland.
Oh.
Yeah, he's been on Daily Show. You ever see the movie Accepted?
Nope.
Oh, you need to watch that. It's pretty good. And he's done some film work, but he does a lot more comedy. I remember seeing him live the second time. And the number one thing he said is that if you're easily offended, you might as well just leave. I'm giving you that opportunity now.
I mean, that's fair.
And the whole point of it was, is that if you can't be, if you can't be offended by anything, you're not going to like comedy.
I think that there's like a difference.
And there were people who got up and left.
I think like the word offended itself has been like inflamed. I think it's okay to be a little bit uncomfortable by certain jokes. I think it's okay to be like, well, that's not true, but it was funny. But I do think that there's a tendency in comedy to offend too much. And this is something that I had a problem with those comedy roasts on Netflix, because it wasn't funny.
Did you watch the Comedy Central ones?
Whichever one was on Netflix, it was like a comedy roast, and like some of the roasts on Comedy Central are really funny, but the David Hasselhoff one is the one I think like.
Okay, those are all Comedy Central roasts.
I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
But there was the ones that were separate that were on Netflix, and they were not funny. Granted, I only watched like 1.5 episodes, but I sat through the Freddie Mercury one, and it's not that I was
a different one. Yeah.
It's on Netflix. It's like a Netflix special or something. But point being, they did one for Anne Frank, which like...
Okay, those are different. It's one thing when you're doing it to somebody when it comes to a roast. Like you mentioned David Hasselhoff, the Comedy Central one. There's a difference with that one because David Hasselhoff is alive.
Yeah, and he volunteered for it.
So there's a difference.
Right, but the issue itself is that the jokes themselves were not funny. They relied too much on sex humor to the point of vulgarity. And, like, Mel Brooks had plenty of sex humor. Sometimes it got a little bit more vulgar than others, but he didn't rely on it. Or the sex humor was, I don't know how to describe it, but to me it felt different. Whereas here, it was just like, how many times can we drop an F-bomb? How many times can we make a penis joke? Like, it's just not funny. And the point of it is, like, you're not even trying to be funny. You're just trying to write insults. And I think that's the problem that I have with a lot of mine, with some of these guys that were at this roast.
So you do know what a roast is, right?
Yes, I know.
That's the point of a roast. The point of the roast is to
insult. I know that's the point of a roast, but that's not the point I'm making, though. I think that if it's going to be insulting, it's supposed to be funny. But it wasn't funny. It was just crude and boring.
I never saw the Netflix ones.
That's fine.
But I've seen the Comedy Central ones.
The Comedy Central ones are funny.
Yeah.
Which one was Ann Coulter at? That one was hilarious.
Oh, God. She got destroyed.
It's because she refused all the good jokes. The good thing is like there's people that will write the jokes for you, and like some of her jokes were funny, but she just didn't know how to like deliver. Her delivery was just
that
obviously terrible.
And sometimes that's the big issue.
But see, sometimes if you're trying to do it, if you do it deliberately, it can work. But it's Ann Coulter. What the heck does she need? She, her entire career is a joke. I don't think she knows how to tell jokes. but I think, like, comedy should be able to imitate life. And I think people in this day and age are too quick to be offended. And I think sometimes that's warranted. I think we need to be vigilant of racism, of anti-Semitism, of homophobic language, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But we also need to understand that, like, I can be funny even when I'm making the most anti-Semitic jokes I can think of, because I'm making fun of myself and my people. And if we don't laugh at ourselves, after 5,000 years of suffering, if we don't make fun of ourselves, then, like, we're just suffering.
Yep. Like, people always ask me, why do I always make fun of myself? Because if I can't make fun of myself, how can I hack it in everything else?
Exactly. And I think that note is actually the perfect way to bring this episode to an end. And thank everybody who's managed to stick out long enough to hear all of our wonderful rants about the man, the myth, the legend, the incredible Mel Brooks. And I hope that if you have not seen these movies, we haven't spoiled too much for you, and that you can...
Okay, hold on. Time out. These movies are dating from the 60s to 1993. If you haven't, well, technically the Dracula one was 1995. So if you haven't seen these movies yet, we're not sorry for spoiling anything. I'm sorry. What's that term? The statute of limitations has expired on this one.
Fair. But hopefully hopefully all the ridiculous antics that you've heard over the past hour have encouraged you to come and watch these for yourselves, judge them on their hilarious timelessness and fourth wall breakage, and just have fun and don't think too hard, because just don't.
All right. And of course you can find Nerdy Notions at txhthockey.com/nerdy-notions. Yes, it's a hockey website, but that's where the podcast is. I have an X75 production section, and that's just where it is. So hooray. Just go there. We'll have all the episodes up there when we post them. There's an archive so you can listen to past episodes. And with that, Sasha, where can the people find you on the social medias?
You can find me on Instagram as the Geeky Captain, or on geekgirl101.tumblr.com. If you listened and you enjoyed it, hit the ask button and let me know what you thought, or comment on the podcast site. Happy to hear from you.
So with that, I open the show, so you get to close it.
Thank you for listening, and please come back to your next batch of torture and insanity.